Kizanyaki with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, the Syrian foreign minister says he's ready for peace talks. Federalist support grows in eastern Libya. The international community wants concrete action from Iran.
The question is whether the Iranian delegation will come to Almaty really ready to roll up their sleeves and help the international community be reassured with regard to their nuclear program.
And a book about the rescuing of three Americans in Iraq. It's all ahead. Syria's foreign minister says his government is ready for talks to end the ongoing violence, but did not offer specifics. Walid Mo'alem made the comment before talks in Moscow with his Russian counterpart. Jessica Golaher has details.
Syrian Foreign Minister Walid al-Mualim is quoted by Russia's Itar Tass news agency as saying, "We are ready for dialogue with everyone who wants it, even with those who have weapons in their hands, because we believe that reforms will not come through bloodshed, but only through dialogue." Mualim reportedly made the comment before meeting with Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. In Cairo, the head of the opposition Syrian National Coalition, Mawaz al-Khatib, told reporters he wants to hear clearly from the government. He says the opposition grouping has not yet communicated with the Syrian government and is waiting to do so to see what will happen. Al-Khatib also said opposition visits to the United States and Russia are being delayed. Moscow has been seen as the linchpin to resolving Syria's nearly two-year civil war. The Kremlin has refused to back three rounds of United Nations Security Council resolutions against Syria, saying that dialogue with both sides of the conflict is necessary for peace, and that it is not the job of any agency to force the ouster of any government. Moscow also continues to sell arms to the Syrian government, maintaining it is not violating international law and that none of the weapons can be used in a civil conflict. Western leaders and Syria's opposition says Russia's stance on Syria is merely fueling the bloodshed that has killed an estimated 70,000 people. In recent weeks, both Syria's government and the opposition have suggested they are ready for talks to end the war, in stark contrast to previous statements. Jessica Gallagher for VOA News, Moscow.
Winter temperatures and higher than normal snowfall continue to plague millions of Syrians who have fled from their homes during months of shelling of urban neighborhoods and the open warfare between government and rebel forces. Much of the displacement has occurred in several areas of Syria, including communities that surround the capital city called Rif Damascus. Reporter David Arnold has been following the problem, and we asked him how displaced Syrians are coping.
The biggest issue is how many. Various agencies differ about the numbers. Some say it's close to 2.5 million Syrians who've escaped from their homes. Others say there are more people who have fled. And remember, that's not the 700,000 or more refugees who fled to Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey, and Iraq. This is just the number who stayed in Syria.
Those are large numbers. What are the challenges they face?
The numbers are hard to count. But I can tell you that the life those displaced Syrians lead is difficult and dangerous. I talked the other day to an archaeologist who's been trying to track unconfirmed reports of looting and destruction of the vast array of Syria's cultural heritage. What she found was that many displaced Syrians now occupy some of the more than 200 villages in the north that were abandoned more than two centuries ago. Under normal conditions, those villages are a national historic park and a tourist destination of immense historical importance in the Fertile Crescent. But to these Syrians, those stone ruins are an escape from the killing.
What about the rest of the countries displaced?
Most of Syria's displaced are seeking temporary shelter closer at home. I talked to the World Health Organization's representative to Syria, Dr. Elizabeth Hoff. She first talked about efforts to monitor public health issues and the steps they need to take to avoid the epidemics that war often leads to. But then she talked about how some of these more than 2.5 million Syrians now lived.
Well, for the internally displaced, and most of them live in schools, in buildings that have not been completed, where the construction has not been completed yet. They have moved in mosques, and depending on sort of which governorate and which area. But what I have seen when I have traveled around the country, like in Homs and also in the Rif Damascus area, where they have large number of internally displaced, is that they have actually taken refuge to buildings which have not been completed, where there are actually missing glasses in the windows, the doors are open. And at this time of the year, today we have snow in Damascus, And in many of the areas, the temperature has fallen below zero, and they don't have the right equipment to stay warm. There is no heating in their homes, and the sort of just the basic and the prices of fuels have gone up tremendously. So, and it's also not available if they can find it at all. You know, so then there are also the problem of electricity. So you can see that at the moment, I think most of the people are very concerned about the winterization here. And it's not only for internally displaced. This is also the case for most of the population here. They are really suffering from the cold weather and the lack of any kind of purchasing power. As I said, fuel is hardly available at all. And also the prices of bread, if they can find it, has gone up tenfold. So for the general population, it's hard, but even for the internally displaced, it's even much, much worse. And here in Damascus, you could see that some of the internally displaced used to sleep in the park. And what touches me the most here is the hospitality and the generosity of the general Syrians to include people in their homes. When I visited Adra, which is in the Reef Damascus, I actually met with families, and I went to refugee families or internally displaced families, as you correctly say. When I visited them, they could live 40 people in a small two-bedroom apartment. And the children who have left, for example, Douma to go to Adra in the Reef Damascus, none of them have gone to the school for the last year. They don't have their paper. They lost everything when they had to leave their homes, and in this sense, they haven't been readmitted to school.
That was Dr. Elizabeth Hoff of the World Health Organization in Damascus. And the conditions she described are certain to get worse as, if most political and diplomatic conditions prove true, the war drags on for many more months and possibly for years.
VOA reporter David Arnold here in our Washington studios. Transitioning to democracy and rebuilding Libya after ousting Muammar Gaddafi was always going to be a huge task, but prolonged political wrangling and regional rivalries are making the undertaking harder, and a growing federalist movement in eastern Libya is complicating the challenge. Jamie Detmer reports from Tripoli.
Support for federalism in eastern Libya is growing, rattling the country's new leaders and infuriating western Libyans, who fear federalists will not just be satisfied with semi-autonomy, but will later demand full independence. Federalists say the central government in Tripoli should only control defense, central banking, and foreign policy, and that oil revenue, which is generated from the oil fields concentrated in the east, should be shared. The slow progress of reform, the failure of national politicians to put aside bickering, and a perception of being marginalized are fueling resentment in the east. Federalist advocate Mohamed Bousia, the son of a former Libyan foreign minister.
There is a surge in number of people who really want to go towards federalism. It's not because they do understand what federalism is, but because they feel it's a way out from being marginalized.
The Federalists say Gaddafi neglected the eastern part of Libya known as Cyrenaica. They claim post-Gaddafi leaders are continuing to marginalize the east. And they welcome also semi-autonomy for the two other provinces of Libya, Fezzan in the southwest and Tripolitania in the west. That would be a revival of the federal system observed for most of the monarchy of King Idris, who reigned after decolonization from 1951 until Gaddafi overthrew him in 1969. Bousia claims that majorities in Cyrenaica and Fezzan now support federalism.
If there were a referendum today, I don't have a scientific way to confirm that, but my feeling that there will be a majority in Cyrenaica and maybe also in Fezzan, a big portion, I don't know if it's a majority or not, that would support a federal system.
Federalist demands are being strongly resisted in Tripoli and by powerful militia leaders in Misrata and Zintan, key towns in the revolution. Even some politicians who harbour sympathy for federalist sentiment say the time is not right. Abdul al-Wahib Mohamed Gade, chairman of the National Security Committee in the General National Congress, Libya's parliament, is concerned.
In principles, I don't reject federalism, but now, during this time, it is not the high time or the suitable time for talking about federalism.
Some frustrated federalists have already used violence. On polling day at last July's national elections, federalists downed a helicopter, killing an election worker, and they torched warehouses containing ballot papers in a bid to halt the voting. Islamist revolutionary militias in Benghazi are being won over by the federalist argument. That includes Ansar al-Sharia, the militia blamed for the assault last September on the US consulate in Benghazi that led to the death of American Ambassador Christopher Stevens. Could Federalist leaders use violence to force through federalism? Bousia thinks not, but remains worried.
No. But, you know, I know that their first concern is the unity of Libya, sovereignty of Libya. And federalism is called for as an internal way of ruling the country. But would they be used by somebody else? Could be.
Alarmed Libyan leaders are doing everything they can to placate Eastern Federalists. That is, everything short of agreeing to semi-autonomy for Saranaika. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Tripoli.
VOA invites you to share a glimpse of your life through photography and become eligible to win a new iPad. VOA helps give you insights into the world. Now we want you to share your world with us. Send us your best photos, ones that capture the spirit or the essence of the people and places in your life. VOA judges will choose a winner. For a complete list of contest rules, go to voanews.com/iPad. Iranian nuclear negotiators are scheduled to meet Tuesday in Kazakhstan with officials from the United States, Britain, France, Russia, China, and Germany. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns reports the six are pushing for concrete action from Iran to comply with international inspections of its nuclear program.
U.S. officials say Iran's installation of more advanced uranium enrichment centrifuges before these talks is yet another provocative step. But State Department spokeswoman Victoria Nuland says Tehran can still take the diplomatic path at talks in Kazakhstan.
The question is whether the Iranian delegation will come to Almaty really ready to roll up their sleeves and help the international community be reassured with regard to their nuclear program.
Iran says it's entitled to a peaceful civilian nuclear program, but the international community says Tehran has not done enough to prove that it's not trying to develop nuclear weapons. Members of the so-called P5 plus one, France, Germany, Britain, China, Russia, and the United States, are working to expand international pressure on Iran to comply with UN nuclear inspections. French President François Hollande in New Delhi.
Je sais que pour de multiples raisons, l'un des proches de l'Iran et de son peuple.
India's influence is very important here because it can help to convince the leaders of Iran to enter a serious negotiation and to bring Iran to respect the international agreements of non-nuclear proliferation.
Johns Hopkins University professor Ruth Wedgwood questions the effectiveness of UN sanctions, even though they've cut the value of Iran's currency and its oil exports.
But the old lesson of sanctions also was the army eats first, the nuclear program eats first, and that countries will give up issues they're not particularly serious about, but they will not give up their core ambitions.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says the international community must convince Iran that its actions are meant to stop the spread of nuclear weapons, not to bring down the government.
Iran must know the overall game plan, if you wish, and must see what is in for him in this process. Otherwise, we have to convince Iran that it is not about the regime change.
Making progress with Iran is especially important following North Korea's nuclear tests. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry.
They're linked. You connect the dots. It is important for the world to have credibility with respect to our non-proliferation efforts. And just as it is impermissible for North Korea to pursue this kind of reckless effort, so we have said it is impermissible with respect to Iran.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the failure to stop North Korea shows sanctions will not stop Iran.
Have sanctions, tough sanctions, stopped North Korea? No. And the fact that they produced a nuclear explosion reverberates everywhere in the Middle East and especially in Iran. They say, where is the world? Where is the international community? Where is the tough response?
Israel continues to threaten a military response to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons as the Obama administration works to convince Israeli leaders that there's still time for a diplomatic solution. Scott Stearns, VOA News at the State Department.
We're approaching the 10th anniversary of shock and awe when the United States and its allies began major combat operations in Iraq in March of 2003. Journalist Greg Barrett, in his book, The Gospel of Rutba, is sharing the story of three Good Samaritan Americans caught up in the conflict and rescued by local Iraqi civilians. The group, 7 years later, along with Barrett, returned to Iraq to thank their rescuers and try to repay their kindness. We spoke with the author about the journey.
The Christian peacemakers were living in Baghdad in an effort to live alongside the victims of this bombing campaign and to live in brotherhood with them. And they were leaving the country on March 29th, 9 days into the campaign. And at this time, on average, we were dropping 941 bombs per day on Iraq. This is just from the air. This doesn't include any ground ordnance. And they were evicted from Iraq by the Baathist Party after one of the peacemakers was seen filming the site of a bomb. Of a bombing site in Baghdad, and they were driving the long highway that connects Baghdad to Amman, and they were about 70 miles east of safety of the Jordanian border when their taxi that they were riding in hit what they suspect was an unexploded ordnance of some sort on the highway. This is a war zone at this time. It blew a big hole in the back left tire. The cab careened off the highway, going at a very high speed, and flipped and went into an irrigation ditch that was about 9 feet deep. And inside the cab was Shane Claiborne of the Simple Way in Philadelphia, Cliff Kendi, a veteran Christian Peacemaker Team's member from Indiana, and Weldon Nicely, a Mennonite reverend from Seattle. And all three of them were injured, but Cliff and Weldon were injured the worst. And Shane was the most coherent of the three, and he figured that even though Cliff's head was busted open and he was bleeding profusely, and Weldon had several broken bones and was in critical condition, that perhaps the worst danger was the fact that they were now without any transportation or communication in a war zone created by their country, and they were carrying those dark blue passports with the bald eagle on it.
And this all just happened right after, locally, they lost their hospital.
Well, in Rutba, 6 miles or so away, the 3 days earlier, a special forces group out of Fort Campbell had accidentally bombed Rutba General Hospital. They were trying to hit what they suspected was a Fedayeen ammo depot, and the fire spilled over from their bombing target onto the hospital and burned down the hospital, which was the only hospital in that whole area.
So what happened to our Good Samaritans after the accident?
The first car to come along stopped. It was a truck with three Iraqis in it, and Shane, seeing it, thought that maybe they were done for at this point. He figured they might be kidnapped, they might be killed. He didn't know what would happen. And the three men ran down and without hesitation rescued them. And they brought them into the town of Rutba, where they discovered that the hospital had been bombed. And they ended up at a clinic. It was just a barren, small, squat, concrete block clinic that had no electricity, no running water. And immediately the staff went to work on them. Dr. Farouk Al-Dulami he confronted Shane and was asking him, why is your country bombing us? And Shane looked at Dr. Farouk and said, I don't know. I wish I could tell you. And there was a bonding at that moment. And this is a lot of what the book goes into later, is this common ground that we all have, whether we're Muslim or Christian or Jewish and American or Iraqi, is this compassion, this empathy that we can connect on.
Greg Barrett, author of The Gospel of Rutba, War, Peace, and the Good Samaritan Story in Iraq. Tomorrow on our program, we hope to talk about what happened when the group of Americans returned to Iraq to thank their rescuers. Palestinian unrest is escalating following the death of a prisoner in Israeli custody. Robert Berger reports from Jerusalem.
Palestinians burned tires and threw stones at Israeli troops, who responded with tear gas and rubber bullets. The clashes occurred at several locations in the West Bank as 3,000 Palestinian prisoners held a one-day hunger strike. The protests followed the death of Arafat Jaradat, who died in Israeli custody. Palestinian officials have demanded an international investigation, saying Jaradat may have been tortured. Jaradat's father, who identified the body, said there were signs of blood on his head. He told Israel Radio that his 30-year-old son was in good health when he was arrested last week, and he blamed Israeli interrogators for his death. Israeli authorities say Jaradat was not beaten during interrogation and that he died of a heart attack. Israel is holding about 4,500 Palestinian prisoners on charges ranging from stone throwing to armed attacks and bombings. A long hunger strike by four detainees has put the prisoner issue at the top of the Palestinian agenda, and protests demanding their release have been growing in the West Bank for a week. The violence has raised fears in Israel of a third Palestinian uprising. Israeli defense official Amos Gilad accused the Palestinian Authority of orchestrating the unrest. He told Israel Radio the Palestinians are spreading lies about torture in order to incite fire and violence on the streets. Israel sent a tough message to the Palestinian government demanding a restoration of calm. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.